Hello and welcome back to Conversations with Claire. Today, my guest is Sean Livingston. He is the host of a new podcast that is crushing it. And he has so many, I'm just like amazed by the whole thing. We went and recorded for his last week and he already has so many in the bank. I'm like, bro, are you going to up the cadence? Like, what are you doing? But his podcast is called I Am Redemption. And I am very eager. I wish I knew the exact date of when ours is going to come out on his podcast, because it was probably the best one I've ever done. Like, I walked away from that being like, that was so good. So anyway, stoked on his project that he's working on. You should check it out. I Am Redemption. He is also a U.S. Army veteran. He is a motivational speaker, a personal trainer. He is a recovering addict and has almost 7 years. You're about 1 month out, yep. A little less than, from 7 years of recovery. So I guess we can't say congratulations on seven, but damn near congrats. Right. Okay, so I'd like to go straight into thank you for being here.
Of course, my pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah. And so how we met is where I like to start. So that's very, very simple, but we got to shout out our girl Danielle.
Danielle.
Yes, Danielle Cobb introduced us. And do you want to tell the how we met at all? Yeah, do it. Do it. Dare you.
You had popped. I'm trying to think. Oh, now you're putting me on the spot.
Yep. It's all about you, bro.
Right. I know. I'm not used to it. I'm used to being the one asking the questions. Yeah. I like how it's flipped. I think you had popped up on my radar just online.
Yeah.
Just caught you on Instagram. I was like, oh, shit, she's in recovery, too. Oh, shit, she's in Austin, too. And I just happened to see there was a couple people that I knew that followed you. Yeah. Danielle happened to be the one I hit up. And I was like, hey, do you, like, know her? And she's like, yeah, that's my girl. And I was like, and then I didn't even have to ask her. She was, from what I remember. But she was like, yeah, do you want me to connect you? And I think within 15 minutes, you and I were connected and we were making plans on seeing what we could do. So
yep.
It speaks volumes about Danielle, how she could just give her word on something and we both know it's golden, but it also speaks to the recovery community and like our willingness and ability to be there for one another.
That's very true. Yeah. Those are accountable people,
mm-hmm.
because we're taught that we must do that to survive. You know, it's like, okay, fine. Yeah, she just called and said, like, hey, I have somebody that I'd like to connect you with. And because of her being who she is, mm-hmm. it was like an immediate yes. I mean, I have a tendency to say yes anyway. We were taught to do that. But
right.
Anyway, it was just like, okay, yeah, this is something that she recommends. And I don't even really have to do my homework. I trust her. So let's go. And that also just speaks to the nature of like having a network is so important,
mm-hmm.
because and making the ask, you know, like you could have not reached out to Danielle with that, hey, do you mind connecting? And then it wouldn't have come to fruition for however long, but within 15 minutes, we're on the phone with each other.
Yeah.
It's just so cool.
Right. For sure.
That there's a lot of value in just like being willing to stick yourself out there. So anyway, and then we just recorded your podcast, like I already mentioned. Okay. So I want you to take me back, give them a bit of context. We're going to go into your story because it is rather profound. And so I will say that after we hopped off of the phone, I did not know who you were at that time, but you have a documentary that's available on YouTube about your journey.
Amazon's where usually where we try to channel, just so you don't have to watch commercials and stuff.
Okay.
So Amazon, you can watch it on for free. It was originally on there for, I think, for a year or so, and you had to pay for it. Now it's on there free, and then it's on a bunch of the smaller streaming platforms and all
sure.
that. But if you Google it, you can find it.
Okay, and I know that I watched it, but tell me again, what's the name of it?
I Am Redemption. That's the podcast. It's called 100 Miles to Redemption.
100 Miles to Redemption. We'll put that in the description. But anyway, I went and watched that, and that was so cool. And it was also filmed almost 5 years ago.
Yeah. So it would have came out right when it was done. Let me see. Yeah. It was probably about 5 years ago because it was set to come out right as COVID was hitting, right as quarantine was happening.
Okay.
So, and it took a couple years for them to film everything and editing and all that.
Yeah. And so I watched it, knew there had been some time lapse from when it was done to now,
mm-hmm.
and knew that life has been lived since then. So I was really excited to be like, okay, I got the snapshot of this incredible feat, by the way, because for anybody to go choose to do a 100-mile race is remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course my nerdy ass was like, all right, how's this fitness after that? Cause that's a lot of volume and a lot of impact to it. Anyway. Okay. So where did you grow up? Let's start there.
Youngstown, Ohio. My mother was a teacher. My stepfather was a steel worker, very blue collar growing up. I had a good childhood, was in sports, became very passionate about basketball. Basketball kind of became my life. Quit all my other sports to play basketball. And then my junior year in high school, I got in a car accident on my way to school one morning. Wasn't wearing a seatbelt, and that pretty much put my basketball career at a dead end, at a dead stop. And so that's kind of where the first time I could see where my life started to go left, because now I had tied my whole identity as this you know, kid basically into being a ball player. And then once I wasn't a ball player, it was like looking around like, all right, if I'm not that, what am I now? And so I just ended up naturally gravitating towards the easiest crowd that would be accepted in, which happened to be the party crowd. And that's what got me started and all that.
How old were you? So you said, did you say sophomore year?
Junior year.
Junior year? That's young. You know, you hear of athletes, it's a very common trajectory, which I didn't do sports, so that wasn't an experience for me, but it's a very common trajectory to get out of high school and then experience that, or to get out of college and then experience that, or if you do get to make it into some professional league once that's over. Then eventually later in life comes the who am I, what's going on? Mm-hmm. Same with military, when they come out of the military. Yeah. But for you, junior year, like, that's a bit early to feel like that identity crisis take place.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's my fault for tying my identity up into that.
Oh, you were a kid. Was right? It really your fault?
Well, I mean, I didn't know. If I would have listened to mom, you know what I mean? How many times my parents told us things that I didn't want to listen to,
sure,
that I go back to now? I'm like, Jesus, they were right. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I thought I was a basketball player. I was all in on basketball. My goal was to play Division I basketball. You know, looking back now, I don't know if I had the right attitude or was coachable that I would ever made it to where I wanted to be. But the accident happened, but that's what ended up. You know, because I didn't have basketball, that's kind of what pushed me towards getting into the military, because I realized school wasn't my strong suit, unless it was something I actually wanted to be there for. And at that time, I didn't know of anything I wanted to learn about. So the military was the next progression.
Okay. So junior year car accident, was there a lot of damage with that?
I shattered my jaw on the left side. My jaw was wired for 12 weeks. Had cracked my sternum, bruised both my lungs, damaged a nerve in my left eye, blew out my left eardrum, lacerations on my left knee, and I busted my right kneecap in half. And so there was, having my jaw wired for 12 weeks, I had lost, you know, over probably 30 pounds. I was trying to suck anything I could through, put every type of food I could in a blender and trying to suck it through the backs of my teeth, just to try to get food in me, but I was just frail and nothing by the time all that was over. And so I tried to get back and started trying to get back into basketball, and it just wasn't. The school that I was going to at the time, they were in contention for state every year, so I had lost so much time over the course of that where it just wasn't practical that I was ever going to break back in or break back into the starting lineup or anything, so I just stopped.
When did the whole party crowd thing come in? Because did you, being that recovery is a big part of your story, at that time I would imagine you were given pain medication. Was that any sort of problem yet or not?
Not really. Okay. The pain medication didn't pique my interest. You know, started, you know, smoke weed, acid, drank here and there.
Acid, casual.
I wouldn't say that's one of the hard, you know, psychedelics wasn't one of the harder drugs.
Sure.
But just the one thing I knew is alcohol never got me where I wanted to be. Weed never got me where I wanted to be. Alcohol was more of like a social lubricant for me, but I'd get a couple drinks in me and it's like, all right, now's the real party. What else are we doing? And so every drug I did, I just noticed, you know, you're raised with this image that if I smoke weed, I'm going to die. It's my brain frying like eggs in a skillet, like the old commercial and stuff like that. And then I would do the smoke weed and I was like, that's it. This is no big deal. Or then I would take mushrooms or ecstasy or something like that. And each one, I was like, this is great. What are they talking about? This is great. And just every level, I just kept going up.
So you're in high school when you're already experimenting with all these different things.
Yeah, never hard drugs until I was out of school. I tried one semester at college, realized almost immediately that wasn't for me. That's when I started kind of seeing cocaine a little bit and snorted here and there. I definitely wouldn't say I was an addict then, but I was a partier without much, I didn't have much limits. You know what I mean? There wasn't much I wasn't willing to do.
Yeah. Well, if you take it back, when you start with this type of stuff, when you're so young, one, you're typically not thinking ahead very far.
At all.
and you're unaware of your own behaviors,
mm-hmm.
you know, like this could be a, become a problem for you because you have this unique desire for this thing. Like you don't know that when you're young. And
right.
so you're hanging around kids who are also doing the same thing and they, I mean, so you go from high school, you're hanging out with the party crowd yeah. by the time you're done there. Then you go to college briefly and then military?
Yeah, then 9/11 happened. I was in my first semester of college. And I remember walking down, getting ready to go to class. And my stepdad was sitting on the couch, and the first tower had been hit. And so I sat there the rest of the day and watched that with him. And I would say within a week or so, I realized I wasn't going back to school. I wasn't really going to school much anyways, to be honest.
Yeah.
Once I figured out the teachers didn't care if I was there, I was out. But I knew that I needed to do something. And so 9/11 happening with me not really that and me not having much direction in life, I was like, all right, I'll join the military. So I joined the Air Force, ended up being in the Air Force for 6 years, and that was all before the Army. You had mentioned the Army when we first started. I was in both.
Okay, I'm like, hang on, did we get that incorrect? Okay, so that gave you a sense of purpose at that age. Like you felt like you were lacking it roughly around 19, and then you had something.
Well, I wouldn't even give myself that much credit and say that I was too dumb to even realize I didn't have purpose. I just knew that I was either going to get kicked out of the house, and wasn't really motivated to go get like a 9-to-5 job. I didn't know what I wanted to do.
Sure.
I would have probably went and worked at Foot Locker so I could get discounts on shoes or something like that.
Yeah.
But I knew I needed to do something to make a move. And so the military was the first and best thought I had.
Okay. Did you like being in the Army?
Did I like being in the Army or the Air Force?
Let's go Air Force first.
So I was too young. Looking back, I absolutely loved being in the Air Force. They live well. I was proud of what I did. I got to fly all over the world. I was stationed over in Germany. But I was too young and I didn't have enough life experience to understood how good I had it.
Uh-huh.
And so the whole time I was gone, I can remember sitting over there in Germany, miserable. Here I'm in Germany, like, you know what I mean? Like beautiful country. So much stuff to do, but I'm sitting over there miserable, like I'm missing everything going on back home. All my friends are doing these big, amazing things. Little did I know when I would finally get out and go back, everybody's doing the exact same thing. Nobody's done anything, and now OxyContin has decimated the area. And so before, when I would go home, I didn't see hard drugs or hear of hard drugs till I was, you know, well out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
Now I go back and there's kids that are 15, 16 years old already hooked on OxyContin. You know what I mean? Like cocaine isn't even a big deal now, it's Oxys.
Mm-hmm.
And just everybody I used to party with and do coke with and all these things are now hooked on Oxys. And so I had started to dabble a little bit and I remember doing those and I'm like, this is great. Like I can snort Oxy, I can sleep, I can eat. You know, like it's so much, it's the polar opposite of what coke was. And coke became so miserable to me. So many nights staying up, no sleep, trying to, you know, waking up, bloody tissues. Anybody that has done coke knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And so Oxy was like, all right, this is cool. And then before I know it, Oxy started to get a hold of me pretty quick.
What does get a hold of you mean?
You know, it started off as just a, maybe two weekends a month. Now it's every weekend. Now it's on a Thursday and a weekend to the point where it just continues to progress where it's every day. And then I remember the first time I had gotten, didn't realize I was dope sick. I'm sitting there going through withdrawals, but I thought I had food poisoning or something, but here somebody told me, they're like, no, you're in withdrawal. And so now it's this, a lot of what I would say my addiction is was a strive to not be sick as opposed to getting high. I needed to be normal and function throughout the day. So it wasn't necessarily always about me getting high or getting real messed up. It was just about me being able to function.
How old were you when that happened?
Early 20s.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when you're slowly progressing your relationship with Oxy, you're starting to do it more frequently, were you able to function in day-to-day life? Did anybody know this was going on with you? Like, what did your life look like?
So I'd gotten out of the Air Force, had a girlfriend. We lived together. You know, I was working just a blue-collar job. I think I was working for delivering duct work for a heating and cooling company. I was existing. I wasn't living any type of life, and I wasn't heading anywhere fast. And so I did that until, you know, just started burning bridges, you know, started losing jobs, couldn't hold something down. And so that's kind of, that went on for a while. The girl I was dating at the time, she was getting hooked on oxys as well. So we held it together for as long as we could. And then I think around that time was when my family was first starting to notice something was wrong. And I'd went to them and told them that I had had a problem. And so they didn't know what to do. They had never had any experience in this. So they thought the answer was get me away from Youngstown, Ohio. That's the problem. The girl's the problem. We just need to get him away. And so for the next 2 years, I would bounce around. I lived in 5 states in 2 years. And I would move somewhere and get all set up and be good for a couple months and then get right back into whatever I was doing. So I bounced from, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, North Carolina, Florida within 2 years. And then Florida I was at for about 8 months or so and just burned everything down there pretty quick. And then that was my first time where I had to make a phone call and like humble myself and was like, I have no other options. I need to get some help. Mm. And so that was my first attempt at treatment.
Okay. So during these 5 moves, was your family pretty involved in facilitating the moves and things? Like, how involved in that process were they?
My mom was really the only person at that time that would deal with me. My stepdad would kind of tolerate. And so it became, they just didn't want me home, because if I was home, then everybody knew what status I was in. They knew I was messed up. They knew I wasn't doing well. So if they could kind of keep me away, you know what I mean, and hope that I got it together, then they wouldn't have to answer those questions.
Well, and realistically, they probably love you and just have no idea what
to do. Yeah, of course. That was definitely, they're not doing it as spiteful to keep me away, but they're trying to set me up for success the best they could. And so I would go burn it down. And then, you know, my mom would say she's coming to visit, and I'd try to hold it together. And I'd be like, all right, I got my dope, I got my Suboxone, I got this, I got that, I'll hold it together. And it would last for about 2 days until everything would come unraveled. She'd know everything. And then it was like, all right, what's the next move here? And so she would do a very good job of like helping me put the pieces together. Mm-hmm. And as soon as she leave, it would crumble again.
So what would you, for a family member, because of course it's like addiction and alcoholism, like these types of things are interesting diseases in the sense of the fact that they get the family sick too. Mm-hmm. You know, they get the people who love the individual also in a situation. And so what would you now recommend to a family member, a loved one of someone who is suffering in the way that you were, that would actually be useful to that individual from your perspective?
So that's probably the most common question I get when I'm speaking and doing all my stuff. And it's the hardest question to answer.
Yeah.
Because we're dealing with people's lives. You know what I mean? I never want to give somebody a piece of advice where it's like, cut them off. Don't talk to your kid anymore. That's what they need. And then they do that. And then that person goes out and dies. Then I'm the bad guy. But in all honesty, what I needed eventually was I ended up landing in a prison cell. And at that point, my mom would no longer pick up the phone. And she was the last one hanging on with hope for me to get my act together.
Mm-hmm.
And so when she stopped picking up the phone, that was like the rock bottom moment where it's like, man, my own mother won't even answer the phone at this point. Like I've really messed up.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the first thing to me. So in answer to your question, I think it's very hard. It goes against every maternal instinct in a woman's body to do it. But I needed tough love. My mother finally understood that anything nice she did for me, I would manipulate in any way, shape, or form to get what I needed. You know, she wanted to make sure I was fed, so she wouldn't send me money anymore. So now she's sending me gift cards. That's cool with me. I can go sell gift cards for 50 cents on the dollar and get my dope money. So keep them coming.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds horrible. It sounds like I was a horrible person back then to do that to a woman who loves me unconditionally. But that just goes to show that's what addiction does to people.
Yeah. Do you feel like you had an awareness at the time that your soul was suffering? Like, that might sound like a strange question, but I know for me, towards the end of my alcoholism, active alcoholism, I was well aware that, like, when I intook certain things,
mm-hmm.
I would just say, like, my soul leaves my body. See ya. You know, but I was so desperate for quiet, mm-hmm. peace of mind. escapism, whatever. I was so desperate to just be okay that I just accepted that reality. But I knew that I was shutting them down, yeah. You know?
I was raised well. My parents did a really good job raising me. I was raised to be respectful. You know what I mean? If I go to somebody's house, it'll be nicer than when I came into it. Like, so many things that they taught me, and I didn't lose a lot of that even in addiction. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I knew that my soul was hurting. It's because the whole time I was like, this isn't me. Mm-hmm. Like, I make these horrible decisions because I'm sick. You know what I mean? Because I'm dope sick in the moment and I need to get what I need to get.
Yeah.
But I was always guilty. You know what I mean? I always knew what I was doing was wrong. And it's just, it went against my core beliefs. It went against my character. It went against how I was raised. And so, yeah, I'd say that, you know what I mean? That ate away at me for years, which then this, you know, cunning, baffling, and powerful, that just makes me go harder to get high so I can forget about what a piece of crap I'm being the whole time. Do you swear on this podcast or not?
Yeah, do whatever you want. Right.
Makes me realize that, you know, I'm being this horrible piece of shit.
Yeah.
So I just want to numb that and not think about it.
Totally. Yeah, well, and that, so heroin was a part of the journey, right?
Huge part.
A huge part of it.
The biggest part.
And so it starts out with Oxy, mm-hmm. but then eventually, when did heroin come in the picture?
I had tried heroin, and then when I moved to Florida, when I moved to Miami, mm-hmm. I got a job. My move was always to try to get a waiter job, whatever I want. It's quick cash. I was good at talking. Mm-hmm. So that's what I would always do. And some people that I had linked up with the first night I was at my job, they were just sitting there talking to them. I could tell they partied, and I was asking if they could get oxys. They're like, no, we can get heroin. And I was like, all right, bet, let's go. And so it was heroin from then on out.
Like, just not even a blink, just a, okay, that's what y'all do, we'll do that.
Yeah. Right to the needle, too. So the way I describe it to people is a normal, rational person would think about doing drugs or shoving a needle in their arm and be like, oh my God, like, that's so bad.
Sure.
So bad. I never had any of that. It was as normal for me to wake up and stick a needle in my arm as it is for regular people to wake up and brush their teeth.
Yeah.
I never had any qualms about it.
I think it's just challenging because one of the things that we know to be true is whenever you say something about this type of behavior with someone who understands it, like, they get it, like, immediately. You know, this makes me think personal training is, of course, big to you. And I was speaking to someone who is working with a program with young men who are in recovery. They're, mm-hmm. they're working on getting sober and so on. And they were asking me, they're looking at the fitness side of things. They own a fitness facility and they're going to help with this, or they are helping with this program. So while they were getting it launched, they were asking me for my opinion, right? And I have a lot of gratitude that they even care what I have to say, you know, and I'm not yet like you, like, it's like, I don't know that I have the right answer. I'll tell you my perspective, but it was like, well, you don't understand what they're going through. So what you do understand is the fitness side of things and how this really helps with your quality of life. Mm-hmm. And so just, like, lean in on what you do know is a good resource and just give them the best information you can and a great experience there. And then let the other people who do better understand what it is that they're going through help them in that category. Like, I don't know that trying to empathize if you truly don't get it mm-hmm. makes a ton of sense. It's why, you know, and so with what you're saying about going straight to a needle and that was completely normal to you, it's just such an interesting thing that we experience where it's like, if somebody doesn't understand how you could, it's baffling. Like, yeah. They're like, that doesn't, there's no way that I can make that make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
Right. So you're not in the army yet, but then that comes into the picture later.
Yeah, so I had, I ended up in Scientology rehab, not knowing it was a Scientology rehab.
What?
Yeah. So when I was in Florida, I told the story a couple of times, but when I was in Florida and I called my parents or called my mother to get some help,
uh-huh.
I pulled a number out of a phone book back when phone books were a thing. And I got in touch with a detox in Tampa. So I go to Tampa. That's where I go to detox. And then I was still speaking with my mom and my grandmother. And they were going to pay for me to go to treatment one time only. And so they were like, all right, do the research while you're in detox.
Uh-huh.
And then we'll send you there. I'm kicking dope. I'm not doing any research. And so all I know is there was a couple people inside of there that were saying they were going to Louisiana. And I was like, cool, I'll go there. So I called, gave them the name. So they're like, all right, we'll send you. So I get shipped down to Louisiana, show up. And first couple of days, it didn't even dawn on me, but I noticed I kept seeing this picture of this guy on the wall everywhere. And I'm like, who's this dude on the wall? And like by day three, I asked somebody and they're like, oh, that's L. Ron Hubbard. And I was like, who's L. Ron Hubbard? And then they told me it was Scientology. And it's funny, one of the other clients took me upstairs, and this is way back when portable DVD players were like a thing. And so he showed me the South Park episode, because he had the box set that explains what Scientology is. So I'm sitting there watching this, like, this is what I'm doing? This is where I'm at? And so I was there for 4.5 months, and then smoked crack and snorted OxyContin the very first night I was out.
Really?
Yeah. Then after that, I realized how bad things were messed up, and so I went back to Ohio. I had a brief relapse, but knew I needed to do something. Mm-hmm. And so I kept trying to get back into the Air Force, but they weren't accepting prior service. And so I made the decision. I was like, all right, I'll go to the Army, join the Army, and now I'm in Texas.
Okay. So Army was your solution to get away from your problems again?
Yes. Tried to.
Yeah. But it didn't work.
Did not work. No.
Real quick, I think that there's also a lack of, and I'm even speaking to this myself, like detox versus treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's interesting, I didn't even know that Scientology treatment was a thing. Like, I feel like I'm living under a rock right now.
I don't know if it is anymore, but it was it's very controversial.
So what's the difference between those two things?
Detox and treatment?
Yes.
Detox you're going to, it's just controlled environment. Usually it's medically assisted, so they're going to give you something for anxiety, something for your withdrawal symptoms. They're going to comfortably get you through your... it's just a safe place for you to get the drugs out of your system.
Uh-huh.
Because to try to check into treatment and go through withdrawals, you're not going to any classes. You're running to the bathroom every 2 seconds. You're dry heaving, throwing up. Like, yeah. It's a whole thing.
Yeah.
And so you go to detox. Usually you're there a week. You can be there 3 days. You can be there a week, 10 days. And then once you're, like, stable, they got you good, you're off everything, then they send you to treatment.
Okay.
Not everybody does all that. That's just how that sure. was my first... I think that was the first and only time I ever got the luxury of detox.
And so how many times have you been to treatment now?
12.
12?
Yep.
Do you recommend treatment?
Yes. So for me, I needed it. And for me, I needed it long-term. What do you think the success rate of somebody that goes and does 30 days of treatment, gets out, goes on about their life? What do you think the success rate is?
Statistically?
Yeah.
I think what I do know to be true is that I can't seem to make timelines make sense as far as who gets sober, when they do, and how it sticks.
Right.
Logically, I cannot. Right. You know? So you could throw any number at me right now, and I would be like, okay.
So 0.02.
0.02.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so that number's staggering to me. Like, I couldn't believe it the first time I heard it. And so I went in and out of treatment, and I think it was... I think a whole host of different things have to happen and come together for somebody to have a successful thing. What people don't understand is there's no treatment center on this earth. And if any treatment center tries to tell you that they will, that they're going to fix you or get you sober, that's not the case.
Okay, right? It does.
The real work happens once you get out. Right. So the treatment center is going to give you some tools. The real work starts when you get out of there, right? It's easy to stay sober in a controlled environment for 30 days, 45 days, 60 days, 90 days. I did it for 8 months. I'd done it for 6 months. I needed long-term treatment, and I needed to have like a progression back out into society. That's just what I needed. That's what ended up working for me, but also getting in the 12-step program, getting around the community, and most importantly, discovering a passion, which I did with running. That was the thing right there.
Mm-hmm.
But long-term treatment was good. I'd spent, 20 plus years putting hard drugs into my body. To think I'm going to go somewhere for 30 days, 60 days and solve that problem is not reality.
Being that you went 12 times, because to me, what I will say about your story, I'm so grateful you're still here. I'm so grateful you're sober.
Thank you.
You give me hope because I do get the opportunity to work with women all mm-hmm. the time and that are in different stages of their journey. And because of a story like yours, I have some sort of like, wow, that you could experience. So each one of the previous times you went, maybe at some point you thought, okay, maybe I can do this. Like, I can only imagine the roller coaster that you were on of inspiration, defeat. Mm. Inspiration, defeat. Right?
See, I'll be honest. I went to treatment 12 times. I probably only went one time for the right reasons.
And was that the last time you went? Yeah. What was the right reason?
Doing it for myself.
Okay. So the previous 11 times you went to treatment so that you could...
I was just either completely asked out, had no other option, was trying to get out of trouble, was trying to please family. It was always reasons like that. Mm-hmm. The last time, you know, I had caught in my third and my fourth felony possession cases for heroin in Texas. I had already been to prison once, and then they were going to charge me as a habitual criminal. And so I tell people all the time, like, when I got out of the military all my life, I used to run around the street and think I was, like, this real tough guy. I was a badass. And I stood in front of that judge, and he looked at me and said he didn't see any reason to sentence me to under 20 years. And when he said that, all the tough guy shit went right out of the window. I was scared for my life, did not want to go back to prison. Mm-hmm. And so at that time, I was just like, all right, all I could do at this point, if I'm going away for 20 years, I had asked my lawyer, I was like, is there any chance they'll let me go to treatment and try to get some help before I go? And he goes, yeah, absolutely. You know, we have a while before you have sentencing. So, you know, if that's what you want to do, go ahead and do it. And so I checked into the VA, and I ended up doing 8 months of treatment in there. And then through that time is when I got into the 12 steps and everything. But at the time, there was no getting out of trouble. I'm going away to prison. And so at the very least, I can try to get sober. So when I go into prison, I can go in with the right mindset. I don't got to worry about trying to kick in county and, you know, go through withdrawals and all that. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, at least so I can at least try to get back in touch with my family. If I'm going to go do 20 years, hopefully they'll be nice enough to write me or pick up the phone while I'm gone. Because at that time, they weren't speaking to me at all. And so that was the reason why I had done it the last time. And so I did eight months in treatment, and then had, you know, like they talk about in the documentary, I'd started compiling this folder of all the meetings I had been to and letters I received, notes I had taken, worksheets I had done, and I had this big thick folder, like a huge encyclopedia. And so when it came time for my sentencing, we sat down with my lawyer, slid it across the table, he opened it up and his jaw hit the floor. And he was like, Sean, I never expected this out of you. Like, you've really started taking steps to change your life. Whatever you're doing, I just need you to keep doing it. Let me talk to the judge, but I need you to keep focusing on what you're doing. And so I went back to the VA and tried to get back in there, but I had just done 8 months. And so they said, you've done too much time here. You know, you have to find somewhere else. So the only place that would take me is a place here in Austin. It was a state-funded facility. It was called a new entry. They took me, but it was a six-month commitment. And at that point, I was all in. I did not care that them telling me that my lawyer saying that to me was the first sign of hope I had had in as long as I could remember. And so 6 months, I was like, yeah, absolutely, let's do it. Mm. And so I went into that six-month facility, and that was a big turning point for me. Was I had some sobriety time up under my belt. I looked in the mirror, and I hated who I saw. I had gained a bunch of weight. Felt like crap, looked like crap, and I just did not like who I was. So it didn't matter how much sobriety time I had. Like, I was miserable with myself. If they would have let me out that day, I would have got high. And so I had started trying to find ways. I'm like, all right, like, I had no idea. I played sports all my life, but as for, like, the science of, like, how to lose weight, you know, I was just like, I don't know what to do. And so I found out about a little running group that met here in Austin, showed up to that, and I would end up discovering a passion that would change my life forever.
Yeah. So time number 12, desperation sets in for self.
Mm-hmm.
Because you feel like the only connections you may get to retain are those with your family if you can get sober. And that was sufficient motivation for you?
Yeah. At that time, that was all I was holding on to. I didn't have much else to try for.
Yeah.
I knew I'd already been to prison, so I knew what I was in for. Mm-hmm. And then going and doing 2 years somewhere is much different than going and doing 20. You're going to a different type of facility, different type of prison with different type of prisoners. And so I was just going to be, if I was going back, I was going to be prepared. And I just wanted to have my wits about me and be of sound mind. I didn't want to walk in there jonesing like a junkie.
The whole thing is just so heavy.
I can remember when I first went into prison, looking around, and I was just like, man, I'm not like these people. I wasn't raised like this. I wasn't meant to be like this. Like, I didn't rape anybody. I haven't murdered anybody. Like, I haven't done any of these things. I just have this problem, and I don't know what to do. I just can't stop putting this stuff in my body. And even in addiction, like, I never robbed people. I wouldn't steal from stores. Like, I'm not saying I didn't do dishonest things, but sure. I always tried to still be as good as a person as I can. I'm not saying I was, but it was still so against my core and my character, but at least I thought it was, but here I was living the life, so.
So I guess then to round out this part and before we get into the fitness, and I have some really fun questions for you about, like, since then, because of course a lot has happened in the past nearly 7 years of your life that I want to talk about that, because as if this isn't already, like, this is dark and then it gets really inspiring. Someone who is themselves struggling with their own form of addiction, and it doesn't even have to be, of course, your flavor at the time was heroin, but it started as something else. For other people, it may literally be sex addiction. You know, mm-hmm. It could be, there's all sorts of different addictions today,
right.
Which there are all sorts of 12-step programs for all of these different things available, which is amazing that we have these resources today that can help us take the shame away from these things that are incredibly shameful, until you enter those rooms and realize everyone else is human too, and you're going to be okay. But what would you say to someone who would like a resource, like, that doesn't know where to turn, but is absolutely desperate?
I would say, if you have no resources, all you need to do is Google and find a meeting. I'm not a big book thumper. I wouldn't classify myself as that. There's people that know that book far, far better than me, but it is my foundation. And that is the only place where you are going to go where, you know, it's so, you know, I do work now within the recovery industry, and I talk to families that are their kids just coming into treatment, or I talk to these guys, men or women, that are just coming into treatment, and everybody thinks that, you know, their story's so crazy and they've done crazy things that nobody's ever heard of and they're going to be judged for it and all that, but there's no other place that you're going to go where you're going to be accepted with open arms. It doesn't matter what you've done, you know, as long as you go in there and keep your mouth shut, listen, and try to surround yourself around with people that have what you want in life, like, good things are going to happen for you. Looking back, I didn't need treatment. There were resources out there that would have got me. I just don't know if I would have had the discipline at that time, me personally. Yeah. I needed to be in a structured environment. You know, I needed that. But I would say just Google and trying to find a meeting of some sort. There's meetings out there for everything under the sun, whatever your problem is. And that right there, not even necessarily the meeting, but the community of people you're going to be around.
Mm-hmm.
I was astonished to walk into a room and find so many people where it's like, oh, like, I would actually hang out with these people. These are just like the people I would have got high with, but now they have their shit together, yeah. And they're good people, and they make money, and they have friends, and they're honest, and they have character, and it's like, wow, like, I found my people. Like, these are more my people than the other ones were. Sure. I think those were the ones I was just hanging out until I found these people.
Yeah. So, dude, I'm just so stoked you made it. And I think I don't know why, but I feel like I want to also share that, like, treatment was not a part of my story, mm-hmm. You know? And so I think it is cool to just touch on the reality that this looks so different for so many different people, and that's okay. That desperation, willingness, all of that stuff seems to need to be present. But once you've got that, you might be in a really good spot to make some real meaningful change with a bit of help.
Right. Absolutely.
So, all right, let's get into the fitness side mm-hmm. of things, because we talked about
stuff.
Yeah, you're like, I'm so over this part of the story. But so we talked about on your podcast a bit, just about, we have all this energy, mm-hmm. and you come in, now you got to stick it somewhere, and you can't stick it where you were. What are you going to do?
Right.
And you chose running.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's taken the shape of different things since then,
right.
Not just running. So yeah, talk to me about, like, why fitness?
So I look back at my life and, you know, I've been through treatment 12 times, and I wonder why did it work this last time? Why didn't it work any of the other times?
Yeah.
Because really, I went to this last one I went to was, you know, the nicest way I could say it was the most modest treatment center I had ever been to. You know, state funded, All food came from donation-based. I'd say 95% of the people in there were fresh off the street, homeless. It wasn't, by no means was bougie in any way, shape, or form. But, so I look back at my life and I'm like, how did I get sober here, but I didn't get sober at any of these other places? Mm-hmm. And I can look and see that me as an addict, I would put all my eggs in one basket. And so first I tried to adjust on my mental health. I get out of the military, they diagnose me with PTSD, depression, anxiety disorder, panic disorder, agoraphobia, sleep disorder, nightmares, you name it. And then they just hand me 15 bottles of pills. And I tried it. At the end of the day, it didn't get me happy. It didn't keep me sober. It was a Band-Aid. Mm-hmm. For me, medication wasn't the answer. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I found out about the spiritual side of life. I've already tried to adjust my mental health. Now I'll try to adjust my spiritual health. And so I get all in the recovery and 90 meetings in 90 days, 12 steps, sponsees, you name it, and did all that. And what I found for myself is I ended up trapping myself in like a recovery bubble where that became my entire world. That was my life, was recovery. Every event I went to, recovery. Every person I went to talk to, recovery. Everything was recovery. And eventually I never ventured outside of it. And so it just would grow boring or resentful at it or whatever, and I would go off. And I just remember my experience sitting down at a meeting, and I looked around and I was like, this is it? Like, I have to do this shit forever? Not saying my outlook on the program wasn't hopeful. Not that the program's not hopeful or a meeting's not hopeful. My outlook on it wasn't.
Yeah.
And so, but nobody ever talked to me about, or I didn't know to ask questions to understand that recovery or the recovery world or 12 steps is my foundation. It doesn't have to be my life.
Sure.
But it's on me to go out and build this life, or it's on me to discover a life. And so I tried to adjust the mental health, tried to adjust the spiritual health. Well, now I'm sitting in a treatment center. I hate what I look like. I hate how I feel. Hate how I look in clothes. Hate even more how I look outside of clothes. And I just hate life. Didn't care much about sobriety. And so I start running and I start having all these things that I never knew it could help. You know, these mental health things that I was diagnosed with kind of start melting away and getting to a point where I can manage. Now it's not controlling my life. It put me around some of the most amazing people that I've ever come in contact with. They would start pushing me to start running races. And so now I'm sitting there and accomplishing things I didn't think were possible. And then, you know, one woman in particular, her name's Penny, she would introduce me into trail running. She would introduce me into ultra running, which I didn't even know what was. And she luckily saw something in me I didn't see in myself. And so I remember finding out who she was, and I heard she does these crazy ultra marathon races. And so I met her and I begged her. I was like, will you please train me up for a race? And so she's like, yeah, I got you. And so she took me out. She's training me up for a race. And so my first race, I ran a 10K. And I got done with that 10K, and I was feeling myself. I was like, ooh, look at me. I just did a 10K. And so I got done, and she did the smartest thing she could do, and she just kind of looked at me, and she's like, yeah, that's cool. You could do more. And I was like, what do you mean I could do more? She's like, you could go farther. And so then my next race was a 30K, and she did the same thing. And here I'm expecting like a pat on the back, great job, and she's just like, nah, you could do more. I know you can. And so then my next race was a 50K. And then in my first year of sobriety, I'd done 100K, 62 miles out in Bandera, Texas. So it's like rugged terrain, hill country. And I got done with that, and it was just this epiphany moment where it was like, holy shit, like, I'm so much more than I've ever given myself credit for. Like, I just did a race in 15 and a half hours and 62 miles. There's most people in this world won't even run 62 miles their whole life. And I just did it in one shot. And so I tied, again, you know, as a kid, I tied all my identity up into being a basketball player. Now, all of a sudden, because I lived in a recovery bubble, now I'm just, my identity's an addict. I'm a dope fiend. I'm a heroin addict. I'm a crackhead, whatever it is. And that right there was what taught me. It was like, oh, wait a minute. Like, addiction might be something that I've suffered from, but it's not who I am.
It's a part of the journey. It's not the
right
story.
Right. And so I just kept doing the running thing. And then my story kind of started getting out there amongst the recovery community, or in the running community a little bit.
Yeah.
And, so Austin Marathon had asked me to do an interview. And so I sat down and did an interview with them. And I remember they had asked me one of the questions I'll never forget. And it was one of probably the most important questions I was ever asked. And they'd asked me if I could go back and talk to my younger self, what would I tell them to change? You know, so none of this stuff would have happened. And I thought about it like long and hard, like a couple minutes. And then I answered him and I was like, I'll be honest with you. Like, I'm very sorry for anybody I hurt along the way. But I know now that I needed to go through every single thing that I've been through to be who I am today. Mm-hmm. And for that, I wouldn't change a thing. Mm-hmm. And so just the running inspired me. I did that interview. The interview went out. I ran the Austin Marathon that year. And then the next thing I know, Lance Armstrong had read the interview. And so now I'm getting an invite to come on his podcast. And so I went on his podcast.
Shout out, Lance.
What's up, Lance? Need you on the podcast.
I really like Lance.
I know. Yeah. Me too. And then he was great to me. He was a great guy.
Yeah.
And then next thing I know, I got a phone call. And it was a director named Andrew Chabé. And he was asking if I'd be willing to do something on a bigger scale. And he started telling me he wanted to do a documentary about my story. And it just so happened I was training for a 100-mile race. And that's where it went.
So it gave you a new identity. Or it gave you, at minimum, something to channel all of your energy. Not all of, but a tremendous amount of energy that you had. I think the profound thing I want to take away from this is just that, like you said, you had really pigeonholed yourself unintentionally, unaware, whatever, and realized, like, that is the foundation piece, right? Was like, okay, yes, here's your foundation. Here's your, because what I see is, like, you know, pre-recovery, it's like, okay, so I'm not, like, I thought I had integrity, principles, values, whatever, but, like, because of this thing that I got going on, this addiction, like, I can't really seem to, like, live within those. Even though I think that that's what my principles are, that's what my values are, like, I can't seem to live. So then you come into recovery and you're like, whoa, I can actually live by those things.
Right.
You know, but those are not your whole life.
Right.
Like, you still have all of these hours of the day where your actions hopefully are in alignment with those things, but, like, you got a lot of actions to take. You got a lot of hours in a day. What you gonna do?
Right.
Definitely. I obviously, like, I agree. Mine was endurance cycling initially whenever I first got sober, because I was like, I don't know what to do. I can't go to the same places anymore. I guess I'll just get on a bike indefinitely. And that was great. And I'd already been using fitness. I think that maybe is an interesting different, you know, I'd been showing up to a gym for years and still suffering in my stuff. And so it was like this compartmentalization of life. And so anyway, what, if you were to package what you feel like fitness gave you, what would you say?
So I had learned so much up to that point. I was very careful not to let it become my identity and just let it be something that I did. But I'm not a scientist, but all I know is when I'm running, my mental health is better than it's ever been. Mm-hmm. That's when I'm at my best, is when I'm running consistently. The health benefits, I felt like the whole world operated at a certain level and I operated like two notches below it. It's like I was not mentally sharp. You know, I wasn't witty. I wasn't any of those things that were natural for me before addiction. And so when I started running, it was like a lot of that stuff started to come back and got me where I needed to be. Mm-hmm. And I think it accelerated the healing of my brain. Like, it, people don't realize, just because you get sober, it takes years for your brain to heal itself again. And so not only was it a passion, discovered a passion, and it taught me, it put structure back into my life. It put discipline back into my life. It put me around, there was people in the recovery community that found out that I was doing ultramarathons. And so they would come to me and they're like, well, you know, you're just replacing one addiction for another. And I was like, I can see why you're saying that. But if you're going to tell me what I've discovered in my life is the first thing that makes me excited to be alive, it makes me excited to get up out of bed every morning, it makes me go to bed early, it makes me wake up early, it makes me eat healthy, it puts me around the best people in this world that I know. So many things I could just sit here and continue to say. If you're going to try to tell me that's a bad thing, I'm not sure we can keep having this conversation. You know, I think everybody finds their own route to recovery. You know, you find what works for you, what doesn't. But all I know is I'm a better person when I'm physically active. It has transformed my life. It's transformed how I interact with people. It's got me confidence. Just so many things I could sit here and list off. But it was cool because there came a point where I had done so much running where I was just kind of tired of running. I was like, all right, what's next? And so then I discovered the gym. So then that was a whole new thing that I could dive into. Mm-hmm. And that I ended up discovering I love even more than I loved running. And so now I know we had talked on my podcast where I became like a big nerd for it. And so here's my tatted ass going to the library and checking out as many books as they'll let me. And I'm sitting there reading about diet and working out and how to structure a workout and what this means, what that means. And it's just like, man, just the whole world opened up to me at that point.
Yeah. And it's so be it. I think that's probably some early days exposure too for you, other people giving you their opinion and you realizing like, okay, that's just your opinion.
Yeah.
And that's not going to dictate my actions because my actions are working for me. Mm-hmm. Like, this is good. So I'm going to go ahead and make my own autonomous decision here.
One thing I want to say, if anybody listening, you know, if they're in recovery or whatever, like for people to think, maybe they're different than me, but I could have never, you know, just got sober and all right, I got my job. I have my girlfriend, I have my car, I have this, and then just like been okay. Mm. Like I put such a tremendous amount of energy into the hustle of getting high every day. And I still had that energy when I got sober. And it's like, cool. Like, because I was able to find an avenue to channel all that energy into a positive way that would end up helping people or inspiring people, not only helping myself, but they wanted to join in and do it. It did so much for my life. It only made all those things, my work, my relationships, you know, the things I was able to get, it only made all that better. And so I'm not telling everybody it's the cure all, but in my opinion, like I work with addicts every day. The people that I see go out and discover that passion or discover that place to channel that energy, they do a whole lot better than people who think they're going to do it without it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we've talked about this, you know, it's just like, to me, I look at it and I'm like, don't squander it. Do not squander it. Like you've been given an opportunity to like start over, you know? And I think it's cool because this is our flavor of it, but everybody has their shit.
Right.
And so whatever yours is, so be it. Let yourself use it as fuel to take you somewhere. I mean, yes, our literature says we're enthusiastic creatures, you know? Yeah. And it's like, I don't think it says creatures, but either way, enthusiastic. I'm like, oh, that checks. Cause right. I very much identify with you that I'm like, got all this energy, got to put it somewhere. Gonna have to accept the reality that it's gonna be imperfect, but this is what we're doing. So you finished the 100-mile race. And I think that because that does exist out there for people to follow along with that journey, there's just more that I want to ask you about after that. So one, I want to commend the action itself because it's incredible that you did that. And it shows people yet again that it's possible, you know? So thank you for doing that. And then if they want to like watch that specific part of the journey, then they can go watch that documentary and get the really intimate, like through the process, what that looked like. And it was way cool. So I recommend it.
Right.
You finish your 100-mile race. Now what?
So I kind of went through like a runner's depression where it was like, I had this goal and it was this huge goal, this monumental goal in my life. And then I had got it and it was like, all right, now what? And so I kept running, I kept running races. The worst thing that ever happened to me with the running stuff was I ended up becoming good at it. And so when I became good at it and I won a marathon, I started placing consistently in these ultras. Now it's put this added self expectation that's what I need to do. I need to win every time. I need to place every time. Mm-hmm. And so I could go on a weekend and I could go run 100K. And if I didn't place or win, now I'm walking away feeling like I'm a failure. And so it's like, I just ran 62 miles. Again, most people will never do that. Why do I feel like I failed? And so a couple things happened were the real reasons that segued me into the gym, which, like I said, it was a gift and a curse that I ended up becoming good at running. And so I was out. What you'll do is you'll kind of have your main races on the calendar of these are the races where I really want to perform well at, do well at.
Sure.
And then you'll use other smaller races as kind of training races where you're kind of honing all your skills or your strategy in for this big race. And so I was running one of those small races. It was a 50K and I was wearing the wrong shoes. And so I was wearing trail shoes that were probably for a little bit more aggressive terrain. And so the rock plate was digging into my foot. And so the smart thing would have been to do, would have just been stop the race, doesn't matter. But I find myself going back and forth for first place, right? And there's about 15 miles to go left in the race. And so the guy at one point when you're running ultras, it's very common. People need to stop and use the bathroom. At one point, he pulled off to pee. And as soon as he did that, I knew I had him. I knew there was no way he'd catch me. So I go on, I win the race, and now my foot's so mangled. I had damaged a nerve in my foot to where anytime I would run, it would inflame. So I couldn't run for like 5 months. And so I took time off, started kind of piddling around in the gym, but nothing serious. Didn't know what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And then...
Well, you also mentioned to me too that like, you started running because it wasn't as the barrier of entry was like, yes, you have a body, you just move it forward, you know, versus going to the gym, significantly more intimidating. There's all these different implements, you know, there's a lot more going on there.
Right.
So that's a relevant piece of it.
Yeah. Huge. Yeah. What kept me away from the gym is I didn't want to go in there and feel like I look stupid. I didn't want people to know I didn't know what I was doing. And now that I train people, I think that's one of the most common things that keeps people away from the gym. Yep. And so that's what got me into running. But, so I would end up going on to win that race So I didn't run for like 5 months, mm-hmm, right? A buddy of mine who's a road runner wanted to run his first trail ultra. So he begged me to sign up. I told him I hadn't run in 5 months. So we go out, I decide I'll run the race with him. I knew I could at least finish. We go out and he ends up dropping in the first 2 miles. He had rolled his ankle so many times because he wasn't used to running on trail. He didn't think he needed to practice on trail. So he drops, and now I'm just out here running this race. Somehow I would go on to win that race. And so I remember getting done, and I was just like, all right, like, I kind of feel like I've accomplished what I wanted to accomplish in this. Not that it wasn't hard or difficult. Every race is hard, but I had just done what I needed to do as far as running goes. Mm-hmm. And then that night I went home, and the girl that I was dating at the time broke up with me over text, no explanation. It was my first kind of serious relationship in recovery. There was no fight. There was no like bad thing. Still to this day, I don't know why she broke up with me. But she did. And I remember going to bed that night and, we had a routine. We'd meet for coffee and then we'd go walk in, downtown Austin around Town Lake every morning. And I remember going to bed that night and I was like, next time I see her, I'm going to be jacked. And then that was like the silly thing that motivated me. The next morning I was in the gym and, I'd never look back. And so still to this day, I've never seen the girl, but met my lovely wife, couldn't be happier.
Heck yeah.
But that was the, you know, it's so funny, hindsight 2020. It's like you go through some heartbreak or you go through this, you think your world's over, and then yeah, you look back and you're like, honestly, that was the best thing that ever happened to me. Mm-hmm. It got my ass in the gym. I discovered a new passion, ended up getting certified to be a personal trainer, started working with people in recovery, work with some of the facilities around here in Austin. And mainly I'm just blessed to be able to do, I discovered this passion in my life. It's transformed my life. And so the fact that I get to share that every day and like introduce that to people that have what we have, as far as addiction and alcoholism goes, and watch it make a difference in their life. Mm-hmm. I never have those days where it's like, oh, gotta go to work today. That dreaded feeling on Sunday night or Monday morning or whatever. I never have that. Like, I'm excited every day. I get to be in the gym all day. I get to talk shit and I get to help people.
I love it. That's what a trajectory to arrive there. What you were saying about the breakup got you into the gym, and now like you look back and you're like, whatever, it worked out. You know, there's a second verse to the Serenity Prayer that I didn't even know about until mm-hmm. recently. Just know the stuff people say.
Yeah.
And the second verse says, "Hardship is a pathway to peace."
Mm-hmm.
And I really like that, and that came up for me. As you were saying that, as that was a hardship that you experienced, and so you chose to take a different action because of the hardship, and here you are speaking about this peaceful existence, this yeah. joyful existence. And of course, I agree with you that, you know, I will say, I don't know that I feel every single day overjoyed, and I have a gratitude practice that gets my mind right. I have my prayer practice that gets my mind right, and so on. But I still, even to this day, experience moments where I feel, you know, self-worth questioning and absolutely. Things like that. So those are times in which maybe I'll go in and I still kind of struggle in some way because I'm doubting self for some mm-hmm. silly reason. And so it's just part of being human, right? But in general, like I walk away from the experience every single time training my clients of like, that was a worthwhile endeavor.
Yeah.
Every single time that was a worthwhile endeavor. And it is so cool, as you didn't get into the gym until you were later in life, and as I didn't get into the gym until I was in my 20s, you know, to just be able to speak to the fact that you could come in later, quote unquote. Like, when did you start to go to the gym consistently after that breakup? How old were you?
30, 36, maybe?
36. So, and of course, you could do it later than that. Obviously, we have plenty of case, you know, of examples of that. But that you can just decide that, okay, you know what? That's a quality of life that I want. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go get that.
Yep.
I mean, at this point, there are people in their 70s that are coming in, getting in shape, getting their trainer license, starting to train people. Like, you can do it at any point that you want, you know? And it's I'm so with you that it's like, this is such a cool thing. And after, for me, all of the years of, like, refusing to do the job, to finally be doing it and be like, why did I wait so long?
Right.
Yeah, it's hard work. Yeah, it doesn't necessarily always have the upside that a previous career had with less work. But it's so worth it. I'll take it any day.
Right.
So I want to talk to you about a couple of other things that, that go outside of this whole... Is there anything else you wanted to touch on the fitness front?
No.
Okay.
Hit me with these hard-hitting questions.
These hard-hitting questions I keep on alluding to. He's like, bro, what do you have? Okay, so what does the word authenticity mean to you?
Being real.
What does that look like? Act it out.
Act it out?
Yeah.
I mean, authenticity, I think, just, I'll say for me, just finally being... finally embracing who I am, whether it's being weird, whether it's being funny, whether it's being dumb, whatever it is, just being okay being me. And so it's funny you say that, as we just talked about the gym, because I feel like running got me back to being me, but not being the person that I was supposed to be. And so, like, running got me back thinking cognitively and being able to speak and all these things. But the gym is what, like, gave me confidence. The gym is, like, what brought me into my own. You know, I think when I got back into running, it got me back to maybe who I was before I started doing drugs and alcohol. Mm-hmm. And it was like when I got into the gym for a while and started seeing the effects on that, and it got me my confidence back. It was like, all right, now this is who I'm supposed to be at this age right now. And so that was the first time where it's like, I don't really care anymore. Like, you don't like me, okay. Like, all I know is I'm a good person. I help people. And I'm real. I just try to be as real as I can, at all times. And the authenticity thing is a thing that I hear frequently. I don't think most people are used to addicts or alcoholics like us just being completely open with our stuff and owning it and being proud of it in the way we are.
Yeah.
And so I think to regular people that are outside the recovering community, they're like, oh my God, that's so authentic. It's like, I'm just being me. I'm just being real.
Yeah. Well, so there's a couple of things with this authenticity that are, you and I spoke, one, I don't know which one I want to go with first, so we'll just go here. Before we started recording today, we talked about the veil and being in a leadership role in certain spaces and really wanting to show up well. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a priority to you.
Yeah.
And then you're also a human who also has experiences and traumas and all of that. That's very real. And being able to, like, walk through the discomfort of feeling those things and authentically feel them and not just try to numb them out, shove them down, pretend that they're not real. Strength looks like a lot of different things, you know, and authenticity comes to my mind of, like, that's a sign of strength when you're willing to be yourself without fear of judgment of others, or choose to, even if you are fearful, do it anyway. I don't know. There's just so many thoughts I have on that.
Yeah.
But how do you navigate all of that stuff?
So, yeah, you and I were talking before, and it's, you know, I've been asking you a lot of questions. I think I'm just getting started kind of in a world you've been in for a little bit as far as, like, social media, podcast, all that.
Yeah.
A lot of it's new to me. And so I've always been okay with putting my story out there, myself out there.
Mm-hmm.
I never had a problem with that, but it's gotten, you know, I'm very aware that through this whole process, you know, the messages I get from people or what they tell me when I meet them in person or people I've worked with, that they, you know, they look up to me in a lot of ways, which I'm sure there's a lot of women that look up to you. And so I've always, now it's like walking around with this added pressure where it's like, all right, man, people are looking for me. They're looking for answers. They look at me as this stable person, this disciplined person that doesn't miss the gym, and they want to come to me for answers. And it's like, all right, I have clients, I have people, friends that I talk to, family, even people that have much higher positions in this world than I do as far as their occupation goes or their education goes, and they come to me for, you know, me for guidance and stuff like that. So it's like, at what point can I be vulnerable? At what point can I, you know what I mean? Because I don't want to shatter that image to them. I don't want them to feel like, oh, he doesn't have his shit together, we can't go to him, which they never would, but that's a me thing.
Yeah.
But I was telling you about how, like, I'm so lucky to have the wife that I do,
yeah,
and have the woman I do in my life, because I just had a experience with her where I was kind of voicing that, and I was having like a, you know, vulnerable moment where it was like, man, it's a lot of pressure. Like, I need to be able to let some of this stuff go, and, you know, just thank God she's in my life and I'm able to do that with her, and her look at me with even more admiration for being vulnerable and doing it, as opposed to just trying to be the tough guy that buries it deep down, like the Irish guy that I am.
Yeah. I think it's just so powerful, that right there, to have a space where you can go and, like, get out what you need to get out. Like, you do get to be this strong leader today that people look to for guidance, perspective. They respect you. What a beautiful thing to get to, and what a trajectory, right? After what we just unpacked, like,
right,
that's so cool. And so then with that comes the pressure. You know, I think of, I don't know, like a teapot or something, you know, and it's just sitting there, like, starting to really get simmering and whatever. Mm-hmm. And you have to be able to let it out somewhere. And so to be able to do, like, we talked about that analogy that I use of, like, unpacking my luggage, you know,
yeah,
of like, okay, so I want to unpack it somewhere safely, but it doesn't, I'm not just going to pretend that it's not there.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I'm excited to know that you have someone who you can do that with, who can then hold space for that and be proud of you for doing it, because it's uncomfortable. I think that's the thing, is like, realistically, like, we'll just use your example, if you don't mind, of in this moment, you're doing that, you feel uncomfortable, your wife potentially feels uncomfortable. Is that, am I making a fair assumption there, that, like, this moment is not void of discomfort?
Yeah, because it's out of the norm.
Right.
You know?
Right. So you have to navigate your willingness to be, let the guard down, to be emotional, to have that vulnerable moment. And then she has to be a person who can hold space for that as best as possible. And of course, like, none of us are perfect. We're not doing it, but I don't know. Like, I, for me personally, in my relationship right now, where I'm able to experience that sort of stuff with Jimmy, and I'm just like, dude, you're crushing it.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you're willing to be a human and walk through this discomfort and not try to numb it out or block it out or pretend that it's not real, and, like, imperfectly just have honest dialogue to the best of your ability about the pressures that you do feel is incredible. That is so, I admire it. And so I think it's cool. I just wanted to touch on that because I think that there's more, we need more of that.
Yeah.
And okay, so I do want to ask you as well, because we've been talking a lot off air before your podcast and so on about you coming into the social media world, the framing of the word influencer, mm-hmm, how you navigate and deal with that. Do you feel, you know, because I remember whenever I first started here, I was like, ooh, tell me that, stop that, that ain't me, you know, whatever. Having to reframe relationship with that word. And then also, as you choose to share your story, as you choose to share your opinion about things, judgment is inevitable. Like,
yep,
people are going to have opinions about what you've said, and it's not going to jive with everybody all the time. And so I guess, how do you navigate that? Why are you choosing to go ahead and use your voice anyway, knowing that you're going to have to experience the discomfort of the noise that might come back at you at some point?
Why am I doing it? This path that I'm on is the first path I've ever been on where it's like, I feel as if I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. Like, I'm doing what I'm meant to do. I was just having a debate with my buddy the other day. For whatever reason, he's just like one of these guys that's programmed to have children. Like, that is his goal in life. He will have children. And so he was, like, trying to... We were in the gym, and he's trying to debate back and forth on why I should have kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, man, I just feel that my purpose in life is to... I've been blessed with this opportunity, with a platform, with all these things, and the ability to be able to go out and, like, share my story and use it to help people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the first thing I've done where it's like, this is what I'm meant to do. And I don't know that, you know, traveling and all that stuff, I don't know I could do it at the level that I am doing it or want to do it. And have that. And so I was like trying to tell him, like, that's just not in me currently, man. Like, it's just, it's not there. But as far as like getting out on and putting myself out on like social media and stuff like that, like, it's nerve wracking. You know, I want it to, it's funny because I know my goal is only to do this to help people, to inspire people, to motivate them to better their life in some way.
Mm-hmm.
But inevitably there'll be somebody in the comments or say something where it's just like, that's not even what I'm going for right there, like whatever you're saying. But luckily you've given me some good advice on outlook on how to look at people like that. But I just think at the end of the day, you know, nothing in this world worthwhile comes easy. And so if that's what I have to walk through to get where I need to be, then that's what I'm going to do.
I love it. So how'd your buddy take that?
I don't know. He's a weirdo. Hey, I was like, bro, I don't know why we're debating this. You want kids? I'm just not. It's just not what I'm. If I was supposed to have kids, I feel like I would have had them.
Gosh, that speaks to me a perfect example of how, like, eventually you just come to understand that, like, you don't actually know what's right for everyone else.
Right.
And the more you can lean into that, like, for me, I know that, especially you'll relate to this, being someone that I get the opportunity to be coached today, whether it's mindset, nutrition, fitness, you know, in the gym, whatever it is, people come to me asking for advice, which I, and not everybody, but like that does happen frequently enough, you know, and I am so grateful to be able to help people in different, like helping somebody move better and feel better in their body. Like it's different, you
right.
know,
yeah.
I feel so grateful for that. But, also having been taught that like you don't actually know what's right for everyone else just takes a lot of the pressure off for you to need to have answers for him or for him to need to have answers for you. And you can just be different people that have different goals. And that's cool. I don't know. That's just a huge hack for me. Cause I can even think of like in relationship, right? So like, we'll use the example with Jimmy again. If like I want to support this person as best as I possibly can. And then also fully understand that like, it's not an apples to apples comparison.
Mm-hmm.
The way that I would approach a situation does not need to be the way that he would approach a situation.
Right.
And so at what point do I need to just support and shut up? And it's very challenging. And I'm saying that because like, hello, it's me. And I think I always got these tools. I'm like, here's some tools, you know, but it's a really cool thing to at least have that frame to be like, dude's doing great.
Yeah.
So maybe just like he gets to do his thing.
Right.
And you don't always have to have an opinion or some sort of like, try to steer them a certain direction. Maybe just like love the human that they are, you know?
Right. I don't, you just saying that reminded me. I remember I just got done with my 100 miler. It was like 2 days after, and I went home to Ohio to visit my family.
Mm-hmm.
And my uncle sat down next to me and was like, you know what you need to do now? You need to do one of those Ironmans. And I was like, hey man, how about one of the Ironmans comes and does a 100 miler? Like, why do I need to do something else? Like, why was that not? I just ran a fucking 100. Excuse my language. I just ran 100 miles, dude.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know what's good for anybody. That's why I'm always so. Even as a coach, even working with people and clients and all that stuff, I still this is what worked for me.
Right. Well, and I love that even when I ask the pressing question about, you know, the questions early about the recovery, what does the loved one do and all of that, like, I am very grateful that because you could have given me a blanket statement, you know.
Yeah.
It's like. A less intense example would be like, should I front squat or back squat?
Right.
Well, we're going to get a lot more context as to whether you should or what, you know, like, so understanding the nuance of every individual situation is different and every human is different and holding space for that and not just giving blanket answers all the time.
Right.
Was cool. So you're doing the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing the fitness training.
Yep.
What's your goal with the podcast?
Help as many people as possible. I took a look around and realized just within my immediate friends and everything, like how many dope ass people I have in my circle.
Mm-hmm.
I've gotten a little taste, you know, what it was like for my story to get out there and watched the messages and the words and stuff that I received back on how it helped people. And that was like this huge moment for me, because all this shame and all this guilt that I had over my story or all the bad things I had done, I didn't know a world existed where I could use that to actually help people. Mm-hmm. So when I started to understand that, I was like, well, wow, like this is special. And then I was like, wait a minute, like we can all do this.
Right.
Like then I even like opened the scope even more as I started, because I realized when a lot of my stuff got out there, I got more messages from people who weren't addicts, weren't alcoholics. A lot of what they messaged me with had nothing to do with addiction, substance abuse, or anything of the sort. It was, you know, childhood trauma, mental health stuff, just this litany of different things. And it was like, wait a minute, like I might be an addict for heroin, but at the end of the day, we're all recovering from something. Mm-hmm. And so just, you know, having the opportunity to start the podcast, and I didn't ever want to pigeonhole it and just make it only a recovery podcast and only that, because at the end of the day, like I truly believe we're all recovering from something.
Totally.
And so getting people to understand that if every person that's listening to this, any person that's sitting in a room with me, we all have this different life experience and it's all unique to us. Mm-hmm. And you've been through adversity that I haven't been through. Mm-hmm. And so you've been through things and I'm sitting here with you now. So you've obviously made it through them. Mm-hmm. And so if you're able to make it on the other side and you've done the work around it, like, to me, the most selfish thing I could ever done in the world was got sober and just went on about and lived my life. Like I felt an internal thing. It was like, I need to do something with this. Mm-hmm. I've sucked the world dry for so long. It's time for me to give something back. And so getting people to understand, it's like, you don't have to be some crazy addict. You don't have to run 100 miles, but you've been through an experience I've never been through. And now you have the unique ability to be able to speak to somebody that I won't be able to speak to. Mm-hmm. And so if I can use the podcast to continue to highlight stories like that, and hopefully the listeners get something out of it and take that message and go on and start helping people, like, you know, it sounds stupid to think like you can change the world and do all that stuff. But think about it, if people actually started doing that on a consistent basis and focusing more on that, the world would be a whole lot different place.
Yeah. Well, we know that we're humans who thrive in community, right? Like we were not designed to live in the world that we live in today, where we get the opportunity to live in our own apartment with this connection solely through a device, where we don't actually engage with other humans in real life. You know, all of this, like the way that things are, so like we can do that today, which is just crazy. And then also, what is that doing to, like, it's not going well. That's what.
Right.
And so you, using your story, using your podcast to help other people share their stories. Like, it is so true that I think everybody's experience matters. And one of the things that's sitting right in front of you right now, that book, I Don't Want to Talk About It. I left it there for a reason.
I was wondering. I was like, she's either still reading it or that's the one she wanted me to know.
I'm still reading it. And I put it there so that you would see it. Anyway, and it's a book about depression, and just it's a therapist wrote a book, and it's for men specifically, but I'm reading it because I want to be able to support the men in my life better and understand them better. And one of the things I'm really loving about that book so far is just we have all of these different versions. Like, I love what you said just about everybody has their own experience and it all matters. Mm-hmm. And for you, so you have these ones that are like, whoa, heroin, whoa, bro, or, you know, whoa, this, like these 100-mile race, whoa. And it's like, there's also, so the world acknowledges that those are a big deal. That's a big trauma. It's a big accomplishment. The rest of the world decides, whoa, okay, yeah. However, passive is extremely real, you know? And so there can be passive trauma that has impacted everything that a person has undergone. And because it's not some acute situation, the world maybe isn't giving it the same green light as a different thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, because I have, you know, a history of alcoholism, like the world looks at that and goes, okay, like you get, you know, here's your trauma, or, you know, just sexual trauma, anything like that. Like, the world validates that.
Yeah.
However, there's all this passive stuff that could have occurred in childhood, which could have literally just been a statement that some, you know, peer or adult, you know, said to you that you carried through life and totally impacted you. And that's all very real too. And it matters. And so I'm just really enjoying that, because I think that the more that we use our stories and stop diminishing other people's experiences is like, that's very powerful. Like, yeah, your experiences absolutely matter. And regardless of the scale of whatever the world is saying, is like, if it happened and it caused you any type of, like, it mattered.
Yeah.
And we should talk about it.
Absolutely.
So anyway, okay, well, that was a tangent.
it's a good tangent.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I'm just fired up about it because I'm so with you. The more that people can use their voice, like, one of the things that I love is just the more that you can show up as a human, the more the people around you will show up as a human. And I know that you know that to be true because you've been telling your story for years now. And so you just know that as soon as you will get real, somebody else will get real with you back.
Mm-hmm.
And often you have to be the one to initiate that.
Yeah.
But it's such a beautiful thing. So, okay. What are three things that you're grateful for today?
Three things that I'm grateful for. I'm grateful for fitness. I'm grateful for my wife, number one.
Shout out.
Jasmine, love you. Grateful I met you. How's that?
I like it.
You know, in all honesty, it's funny how things work out in life. I feel a lot of what I've been doing as far as podcasts or social media or this stuff, I've just been kind of, I don't know. I'm just going to go with it. We'll see what works. But then to see somebody that's, you know, progressed and farther along than me, and you to kind of come in at the time you did, you know, I'm very grateful to have met you and say that we have a friendship and stuff like that. So yeah. Just excited, especially to find somebody else in the recovery community that gets it.
Mm-hmm.
They get the fitness stuff. They get the impact that it has. We can take a look at the outside world and understand how much fitness can impact it and do good in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely grateful for that too.
We all need more of it. We all need more of it. Okay. Thank you. And I'm excited too. I think we talked about on your episode as well, on your podcast, about just the perceived success versus the, you know, and so how it can, like, I'm in the same boat as you of in 2022, late 2022, some, you know, enough people said, you got to do a podcast. But then I think the perception of the success of the podcast versus as far as like, oh, it must be monetizing or this or that, you know, and what it's actually doing are two different things. But my relationship with it, I know we've already talked about this, but I just feel, you know, like sharing it here, you know, it's such a beautiful container that I don't have too much attachment to what happens with it. I just love experiencing it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's cool. You know? And if it's received well and it's helpful, I love that. But I love just being a part of it anyway.
Yeah.
And that wasn't the expectation when I started it.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be cool because we'll play this out over the course of the next few years. And if you just keep doing something for any length of time, usually something pretty cool happens, you know? So anyway, okay. Three things that I'm grateful for today. I am grateful for my clients. It's just, they help me get outside of me all the time. And so I'm really grateful that there are people that trust me with their fitness enough to show up and give me a reason to show up. And I get to walk away feeling like that was cool. So I'm grateful for them. I am grateful for this. I just said it, but the podcast. I write 5 gratitudes every morning, and it was one of the ones getting to compartmentalize this conversation like this, and then we get to reflect back on it when we're 5 years down the road and we're both doing this and it looks totally different or whatever we're up to, you know, like the early stages of the friendship to where it is later. Like, that's such a cool way to encapsulate these moments. So I have a lot of gratitude for that. And then I do have gratitude for Jimmy and some of the conversations over this past weekend alone. I think if I'm going to be really real about that, like, he's asking about certain details of my experiences so that he can understand me better.
Mm-hmm.
And it literally, like, it's jarring.
Yeah.
In this moment, I'm confused. Because I'm like, I don't understand.
Somebody even cares about the dark parts of my life.
Somebody even cares enough to ask the question, hear me, and then not
judge me for it.
Judge me? I'm confused.
Mm-hmm.
So very grateful for exposure to that type of treatment and just like still like, huh?
Yeah.
I literally didn't even, no one's ever done, huh? It's confusing. But anyway, so shout out, Jimmy. I appreciate you. So, okay. Where can they find you, support you?
I am dot Sean Livingston, SHAWN on Instagram. I'll be honest, I don't even know what my TikTok thing is, but it's Sean Livingston, SHAWN. And then on any social medias, IamRedemption.com has all the podcast stuff. I Am Redemption on any streaming platform, YouTube, everywhere else for the podcast. We have amazing people come on here like Claire.
Yeah.
So if you want to hear some more inspirational stories, check it out.
And that girl that we mentioned at the very beginning.
I was just going to say, yep. I think we are both thankful for Miss Danielle Cobb as well.
Absolutely. And that episode that you recorded with her is live. So people can go watch that now. It is. And
truth be told, it was one of the very first ones I did. So I've gotten much better as a podcaster since then.
It's okay. I'm sure she carried you.
She fucking crushed it.
I'm just
she
kidding.
Crushed it.
Yeah. I actually have not gone to watch it yet, but I'm very excited too, just because I adore her. So anyway, and you've got a great production, so it's just worth mentioning as well. But like, it's a solid, high quality production
Very lucky. The production far outweighs my skill as a podcaster. So
you say that.
It's carrying me through.
I already told you the one we did the other day was like money. So, okay, I will put his stuff in the show notes. So if you want to follow up with Sean, of course, you can communicate with him there. You can catch up on what he's up to and just support him. And so we just want to round this puppy out. Oh, let's see here. Okay, I always have to do this at the end and I forget. My coaching business is something that I do online as well. Is there anything that you wanted to plug besides where they can
What I was going to say is if, you know, you view somebody you love suffering, I'm blessed to have relationships with some of the best places in this country as far as getting some help. I have tons of resources. I know Claire does as well.
Yep.
But if you need help or you need somebody to talk to, please don't hesitate to reach out.
Awesome. Yep. There you go. And that's
coaching business.
So cool. Yeah. I just appreciate the fact that you're like, it's just so cool to hear somebody else do that, you know, to be like, yeah, if you need a I can only imagine how many people that you have profoundly impacted by your willingness to do that.
Thank you.
That's a big deal. So yes, I do run a coaching business. It's fitness, nutrition, mindset, all of that, online coaching, and I have group and one-to-one offerings. If you're here in Austin, I do that in person as well. So if you want to connect over any of that stuff, and I think the main thing is just move better, feel better. You know, I want people to move better in their bodies. And thanks to being a pain-free performance specialist and a number of other things, that's something I could do like, all right. And I'm pretty dang proud of it. So if you're interested, let me know. And other than that, we're grateful for your time. The fact that you've chosen to come hang out with us in this way, like your time is incredibly valuable, just as Sean's is, just as my own is. How cool is that? Your time is valuable as well. And so we appreciate you hanging out with us and hope you got something of value out of this. If you did, of course, if you would share it. Also, if you subscribe to the show, that's also a wonderful thing to do helpful-wise. And we just hope that you choose to have a beautiful day. That's a wrap.
Bye, y'all.
Bye.